Accession number 29431, Reel 4.
Like, would you just say what Richard did following the war, after the war?
Well, after the war, I went back to the civil service job I had, because I thought about various things. I had various options. Including, I suppose, going to university if I wanted to. But I decided to go back in and just slog away in the civil service and gradually get a few promotions and jobs, because the service, my service, my war service counted. In other words, I had 7 years in the army, but that service had also counted towards service in the civil service. So I thought, as a matter of expediency, what shall I do? I had no ties, simple. No particular connection at that particular time, and a lot of my friends had married. I mean, two of my girlfriends at home, in my home, and married them, you know, and I suppose I was left on the wall, really. Here we are. I was a bit slow. So that's what happened. But the big thing after the war I was very keen on was music. I mean, after the end of hostilities, because I made that specialist amplifiers and things in a unit, I used to run a music appreciation evening and got records on loan through something to do with the NAFI, I think it was, and they used to send them for me, and I used to know the program and classical stuff and set it up, and people came to see that, to hear that. And I had been very interested also in the piano. I am an amateur pianist, and I've been very keen for the war. I've done some work on two pianos. I got introduced to a professor at the Royal College who helped me get back a bit into practice. And in fact, with a friend, took part and managed to be fairly successful with a two piano competition. That was about 1948. I should also perhaps mention my interest in the piano, which was that I did in fact rescue the piano which was in my parents' home, my own piano, because the road was blocked. With an unexploded bomb, and a barred, and I managed to borrow a lorry and a couple of mates. We went in and moved the piano over to a friend's house in Putney, and the friend's mother very kindly used to said to keep the piano here for safety, and it was there during the war, which was very nice, very kind of her. And
have you still got it?
No, my daughter has it now. But it was a very nice old piano, because my mother was quite musical, and she had got this piano somehow from the Maker, and they're called Night. And I think I've still got the receipt actually somewhere. I've had it now. And it was a very lovely upright piano, and very good in tune, and they had some good lessons to playing it. And I started this two piano work before the war, and I went back on to that for a little while in this competition. And then when I married, that stopped, and a friend married too, and we parted a bit on that. But I kept my music going, although at one stage of my career I was an inspector with a mobile job, and it was very difficult because we were living in the Midlands, and I was away a lot during the week. And but I kept it going. I even got as far as thinking, well, perhaps I have to make a record of myself playing and play the second piano part of the record, which was also very feasible. I did try some experiments with that. But we had two daughters, and the younger one is very musical. In fact, she's a professional musician. And we played a lot of two pianos together. I bought a nice old Bechstein grand. And quite an old one, he's over 90 years old now. But we played together at two pianos. I had a music room built at home. An architect friend of mine, who's also a musician, designed this music room. And at one stage, post-war, after my retirement, I also had some lessons from the piano tutor at the university. I was introduced to you by my daughters, actually, as a professor at the and in fact I spent some time, about a year or two, restoring a lovely old Gordon band, which I subsequently sold, but this was going to be thrown away, and they were moving their recording studio, and I moved to the university, and I was asked to have a look at another Bechstein there, and I saw this old board put up in pieces in a pretty bad state, and I got that. Well, they gave it to me really virtually. And it took a couple of years in restoring it into a reasonable playing piano, taking it all to bits. That's one sort of little minor things I've done in my time since. And we've made a number of recordings. Video stuff as well. Sonny Moore, they came with that.
That was your daughter?
Yes. She's a professional cellist. We did some early recordings of two pianos, but the recording wasn't good in those days. But we had done some better cello and piano recordings. In fact, I played for her audition to the Royal Northern in Manchester. She went there. We just play about once a year. We did actually give a concert in Guildford a few years ago. At the Grammar School, briefly. But that was the late 70s, I think, late 80s, some time ago now. But we still play together, but of course I'm quite old now. And those days are gone away. Though I still keep up a little bit.
Following all your experiences during the war, what feelings are you left with, and how do they compare with after the war? After the war?
Well, just after the war, a feeling of a little bit of frustration and disappointment. I don't know whether... Can I read a quote from...
Please do.
In fact, my parents bought me Eric Linkling. Lakers book on the campaign in Italy. It's very detailed, all the fighting. And I wasn't involved in a lot of the fighting because we were in base areas doing the communications. but my heart goes out to those who did. I mean, we went, my wife and I, to the Gurkha Museum a couple of years ago down in Winchester. They were putting on a special retain episodes in there. You know, the room there is full of VCs. We always had the old British Army, the greatest respect for Gurkha soldiers, and they fought brilliantly there, as everywhere. But I would like to just, the thoughts I've always had of the Italian campaign, I think my thoughts are that it hasn't always been appreciated how hard it was, the campaign and the territory and the resources, because a lot of the fighting troops were drawn for the North African, for the North European landings, which were taking place a year later. And we just went on fighting our way virtually meter by meter up the very difficult terrain of Italy, with all bridges blown. They were, the Germans were a tremendous enemy. We had the greatest respect for them, and they put up a very hard fight. And in the words of Eric Linklater, in the final chapter of his book, he says, "The campaign had been hard and cruel and bitter with death, and victory had brought them but a doubtful peace, and granted them leave to live in a world that was angry still. They had won their war and had beaten a powerful enemy of high temper and superb accomplishment in arms. There will be those who remember with awe, sitting in peace in their vines, the storms that preceded their happiness. There will be some who talk of Alexander and the great names of the regiment, the regiments that he led." That was the after the war, and that's what the feelings now. A bit of dismay, really, because we seem to be going to a terrible state of goodness knows where, downhill. And my thoughts are with the younger generation. One has the feelings of despair for them, because it's such a troubled world. And even today, in this business now, and there seems to be no contentment. And when I think back to my days of childhood, when I lived in what was virtually a village atmosphere, and I was happy. I had brought up with a very nice family. I always think of Christmases, surrounded by uncles and things who used to bring me parts for a train set so they could come and play with themselves. And schooling was happy. Well, reasonably happy. And life was a bit orderly, a bit more leisurely. We were all short of money, but there were no what I call untoward expectations. People have perhaps in some ways too much too soon, and you wonder where it's all going.
Thank you for sharing your experiences with me.
I mentioned my work on an armoured train. That was very interesting because it was something which had been thought up especially for first line of defence, coastal defence, because it was manned entirely by Polish officers. It was 1941, I think, and they had more officers than men. What could they do with them? So they put them on this armoured train they did all the fighting and all the commanding as well. And boy, they would have fought like tigers. I had a small contingent using the radio link to Corps headquarters. Corps headquarters was down near Newmarket, and we were up at Hunstanton on the coast with this armoured train. constant steam up, ready to go around the single track line to Wells next to the sea and on that way, or down the other way, down to down the side of the wash via Sandringham, the posh station there for the estate. But the interesting thing was that the radio was well protected. The size of the thing is very heavy armor, nothing on the top. But the radio set was protected. The poor old operator sat in front of the radio set, unprotected, apart from the side, of course, and they protected the throttle, apart from his steel helmet. But they would have fought like tigers, these chaps. I got on very well with the, I think it was the liaison officer who was interested in radio, and we talked a lot about radio, and his English was very good. And he was fascinated by all the bits and pieces of communications and leaflets and things I'd picked up by going to radio shows before the war. I lent him some of them, and in fact he wrote off and got copies himself. But it was an interesting talk, because it was quite new to this Polish officer, anything like the radio show in pre-war in London, where you could go around all the stores and check up all the information you wanted. But I was on the airfield for a number of months, and we used to go out on a run every so often. The only problem was that in those days the line, single track line, was held together, not the modern system of key things holding the sleepers. There were shoes, like a sort of metal shoe, and the rail was held in with a wooden chock, block, which had to be knocked in, and these blocks had to be knocked in by the linesman, obviously the rail lineman, as part of his duty when he went along. Unfortunately, this armour frame was so heavy that it knocked an awful number of these out every time it moved. But it was quite fascinating. There was another one on the coast, I believe, down near Canterbury. That's the first line of defence, coast defence, against possible invasion by the Germans. The thing I also think about very often is the wonderful comradeship which existed with my generation in the forces, especially when you were overseas. You weren't really terribly rank conscious anyway. I mean, you were all fighting, you were all fighters, and were part of a unit, part of a team, and you fought and worked and acted as a team. And but it's something very special and something very close. I unfortunately, being rather young at the time, I was about the youngest person, and I'm afraid most of them have gone now. In fact, the reunions I went to for many years were with the unit I first joined in North Africa and in the Salerno landings, and I met one of the chaps who used to work with me in the Strand in London, and bumped into me and told me about a reunion dinner which this lot had every year, run by one of the colonels, and so we used to meet at various places in London, and the fascinating thing was time stood still. It's though you were back there in time. We used to talk together and drink together and have a happy evening together. And as though you were back X number of years, it was as close as that. But sadly no more, it got down to about two or three, and then they rounded up and sent the money off to some charity fund. At that particular time, we were all a bit fed up. You know, we were all thinking of getting home, because we'd been through the whole campaign in Italy, and it was looming that we probably, at that time, the Far East, the Japanese thing was still open. The possibilities we might even be going there. So we were a little bit brown off about them then. And I got to this unit, and all the transport and all the apparatus were a bit neglected. they were a nice enough crowd, but they were in a field, and the TM section, they were running lights all around the field for night time, because otherwise the Italians were coming in and pinching stuff. And so we were running this big battery charging railway just to do that. And the headquarters where we were was a little railway, I suppose about a quarter mile, half a mile, something like that. We could walk there quite easily. And I was a bit in despair myself as to how I was going to get this done, because everyone was thinking about home need. And off for 28 days. And you've got to get this stuff in a fairly fit state. Obviously, it was going to be used to probably go to the Far East, or was going to be used operationally. So, hit upon the idea of borrowing some technicians from the German POW camp, which was nearby. Cages, they called it. So I got some skilled technicians under a sovereign major from the local POW cage, as they called it. And I've never had people work so well, or so willingly. Of course, it gave them a chance. I mean, they were wasting their time in this thing. It was the end of war. They were worried about their families. Some of them were from the east of Germany, east of Germany, and were country chaps, you know. And it suddenly dawned on you, they're just like yourself. And so we socialised pretty openly. And, you know, we were doing our work. And they kept us a unit, they slept together in their own dorm. And we gradually looked after them. I mean, they were a bit short of underwear and stuff like that. Well, one of my friends was the company quartermaster, so I didn't got an issue of new underwear for them and weather and stuff. Then afterwards, I had leave myself, and some of them had. They put in all the cars were looked at. The motor mechanic side, very well done indeed. All really done up nicely. You know, points cleaned, plugs changed, and everything like that. It's all very good indeed. And but it was a bit dodgy suddenly in those days. A lot of the Italians, I suppose, mafia orientated and things like that. And we moved from this place back into Foggia, and to show the state of affairs, we shared the compound with the local major in charge of the military police. And he came out one morning, and all his wheels and tyres had gone, and his Jeep was up on bricks. That's the sort of state of affairs. And so, you know, you had to be very careful with things. But I remember that one of these chaps that we were still working for, the same one as these German chaps, he was picked up by the military police on a Sunday going to Mass, I think. And brought back to us. So I simply arranged, one of my chaps was a Catholic, and I arranged him to go to Mass with him on Sunday morning so that he'd have someone with him. But it dawns on you, you know, that young people like ourselves caught up with events and suffered exactly the same sort of indignities and hardships and families and things like that. When you think of the bombing of Dresden, the firebombing, what was the world thinking about? Anyway, that all came to an end, and I got the posting now. But they were good workers, those chaps, and we certainly got on very well. We disobeyed all the rules and drank and fraternised with them quite well, I'm afraid. So,